Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you, dear. Happy birthday to you.
This is Henry Jaglom. You are listening to FilmWax Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Adam Sharkoff, your host of FilmWax Radio, episode number 458, a special bonus edition this week. This is a conversation I had a couple months ago with the legendary filmmaker, Henry Jaglom. It's his 80th birthday today, Friday, the 26th of January, 2018. So for this special occasion, I'm releasing this special episode where he talks about his whole career and he talks about his relationship with Orson Welles. He talks about his very controversial friendship, I guess you could call it, or certainly a relationship of sorts with Elia Kazan and how he reconciled that. He gets very personal, actually, and he's a wide open person. That's why I like him. The contrast of his films over the years is striking. From the late 60s, being part of the movement of these young Turks who were making avant-garde types of films outside of the studio system very early on, and since has had a decades-long career making many films and always working independently, making highly intensely personal films over the course of time. He is still making films. He not only that, but he's a playwright and often adapts his plays into films as well. He's had relationships with certain actors over the years who creating kind of a stable of regular actors that work with him over many years. And so he's really has a very singular career that very few other, unlike most filmmakers in, very few other people have had careers anything remotely like that of Henry Jaglom. Well, here he is at 80 years old. He's still going, not slowing down, and still has a lot of that same edginess that he had 40 years ago. So without further hesitation, let's go right now into a conversation. Henry was on, by the way, some time ago, but he's back on for an extended conversation, so I really appreciate that. So thanks to Henry and thank you to his team, and I appreciate it. So here now, my extended conversation with filmmaker Henry Jaglom. Happy birthday, Henry, from your friends at FilmWax Radio.
You know, it's a great problem of movies. Is that they're always old-fashioned. It takes too long to make a movie. By the time your idea is on the screen, it's already dead.
Someone to love, someone who wants to reach out.
Okay, kiddo, gotta go sleep.
I gotta get up real early in the morning tomorrow morning, you know? I have an 8 o'clock call.
Okay, so you look good. Get up early? We'll get up early.
I'm not going to be able to go to sleep if you're here.
Why not? It's the third time you've told me this.
I'm sorry, but I just...
When are you going to be able to go to sleep with me here?
More and more populated, and there's less and less room. And there are the apartments in which marriages are supposed to work get smaller and smaller. More and more people are going to rush out in the street and kill everybody they can find.
There?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Can you hear me well?
I can hear you perfectly well. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you. Yeah.
Are you? You're in New York?
Yeah, I'm in Brooklyn, New York.
Uh-huh. Brooklyn, New York. I never heard anybody say that before.
Brooklyn?
Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah, I know. It's a very obscure location. And when was the last time you were in Brooklyn? When was the last time you were in Brooklyn? Let me just ask.
I haven't been in Brooklyn in 40 years.
Wow. You would be quite shocked by how much it's changed. Maybe you wouldn't. I know.
My daughter. No, I would be. Of course I would be. Mm-hmm. My daughter, who went to NYU film school until a year ago, spent all, I mean, I realize that all the young people now and a lot of artists and people are living, going to Brooklyn, whereas we used to go to the Village or Lower East Side or wherever.
I think we're even...
I wouldn't recognize Brooklyn.
I think we're even getting to the next phase where people can, you know, students like your daughter probably, or like, and I say like your daughter because I don't know your daughter, but, you know, are even probably having to look elsewhere too because Brooklyn has become so expensive and, you know, it's just...
That's what happens one place to another. So where are they going? Where are they going to go next?
That is the question. So it, will it be Queens? Will it be... Staten, you know.
I can't imagine. it's hard to imagine Queens.
I know.
It's a to a hip place to be, but I guess it's all, everything's possible.
It's true. Well, there's a couple of...
Isn't that where Trump's from, Queens?
Don't remind me. The bad news, Henry, is that I, too, admit that I am from Queens. Originally, I am.
That helps balance out Trump.
Thank you.
It reminds me that not everybody from Queens is Trump-like.
No.
I used to go, when I was in college, I dated a girl for most of my college years who lived in Brooklyn. So I used to always take her home to Brooklyn, and that's for Brooklyn is, of my mind, is a completely different place than my daughter has described.
Right. Where was the neighborhood that your girl, do you remember the neighborhood your girlfriend lived in, or?
Yeah, Eastern Parkway.
Okay, yeah. So Crown Heights or something like that, probably. I'm guessing. Yeah.
What?
Probably like Crown Heights or something like that, I'm guessing.
I have no idea what the comparable
thing was. Neighborhood. So this timed out pretty well because actually I wasn't sure what was going to happen with in terms of talking to you. So tonight, because I just came back from something in Manhattan, and then I got to the last half hour of Rachel Maddow interviewing Hillary Clinton about her new book. So I was glad to catch some of that.
You haven't seen it yet?
No, it was just on here. It was just on, and I caught...
It was on last night. It was on last night.
Rachel Maddow?
Rachel Maddow. Yeah. Her interview with Hillary was last night.
Well, that's
so
odd.
They ran it again tonight?
I guess. I thought it was today, but, you know, maybe...
No, it was last night. I saw it yesterday. It was sensational.
Let's talk about that for a second before we get into... everything else, and because I'm as somebody like who specifically has spent so many years and so much of his creative energy excavating the female experience or experiences through
That's
the female.
Good. I like that.
Yeah.
Female experience.
Well,
yeah.
Truly, I mean, I certainly watched enough of your films to state that with great confidence. You know.
Yeah.
You know what an opportunity lost not to have a female president.
Yeah,
and then just
especially that.
Yeah, so I take it you were an advocate.
So great, I have no understanding of what the people who are against her what they're talking about. I just never could figure out what they were.
Yeah,
what was going on? To me, she's spectacular in that interview. So did I stop you from watching the rest of that interview?
No.
After the interview?
No. And they'll rerun it later. And even though I'm probably going to try to stay up later. Or
I'm surprised they're running it again today because it was on yesterday.
Did that make I'm trying to understand how that could be because we get the same on MSNBC, Rachel Maddow. Or did you watch it on her being interviewed by a different media outlet?
No, that was Rachel Maddow.
Okay.
A great interview with her.
Isn't she great though, Rachel?
Wait a minute.
Hello.
No, you're right. That was, what's his name on MSNBC? On MSNBC, on CNN.
CNN.
You know.
Not Anderson Cooper, but somebody else.
Yeah, Anderson Cooper.
Oh, it was him?
That's the one.
Oh, he interviewed her before Rachel Maddow?
Oh, shit. So, he did it before Rachel Maddow, I know.
Yeah.
That's surprising. And then I remember that Rachel said that she was going to be on the next night. What time is it now?
Well, right now, in your neck of the woods, it would be 7:15. So they're going to rerun it again later.
Oh.
You'll get home.
I'll see it later tonight.
Yeah. I won't keep you on that long, for God's sake.
No. I see Rachel Maddow when it reruns around midnight or 1 o'clock usually.
Oh yeah. Don't you just love her?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I love her.
Sensational. She's extraordinary.
Really.
One of the greatest things that's happened to television.
Yeah.
And but I did see the interview with Anderson Cooper and then the discussion afterwards.
I didn't.
Which
so.
Included Carl Bernstein.
Anderson
Cooper. And it was she was just tremendous. Yeah, it's very depressing in a way, realize what we lost, what we missed.
Very true. And I hope, you know,
what we got.
Yeah, well, that is a rabbit hole that I'm not, let's not drag each other down that, because that's another, you know, YYN. Let's talk about something a little bit more positive. And
okay, lead the way out of the rabbit hole.
Let's start with, because if I'm going to have the most listeners at any point, it's going to be at the beginning, right? So I hope that I assume they'll stick through the whole thing. But let's just start with your new film. I don't even see anything about it online yet. But you did send me the link to
it. Train to Zakopane, you mean?
The Train to Zakopane. Yes.
Yes, because it hasn't opened commercially yet.
No, I understand. But it was a play.
Yeah.
Clearly,
it was a play that ran for a year out here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for a year.
And it's just finished running for a tremendous 8 months in Israel, which is really amazing.
Gee whiz.
They translated it into Hebrew. Some very enterprising people. Because it deals with a subject that is of interest to Israelis, because it deals with anti-Semitism in Poland in the 1920s.
Yeah. Exactly.
And in that sense, is very different from all my other films, obviously. So what can I tell you about that film?
Let me ask this. When is it the plan? When do you plan to release it?
I have no idea.
Okay, right. Okay, so
I don't yet know who is distributing it.
Right.
It is somewhat larger than my own film. It's more commercially structured so that there are people who are contending for it now, so I don't think we're going to distribute it ourselves, and that means I have no idea when it'll be, though I expect it'll be in the early part of the next year, probably at the early part of the next year.
Then the beauty part of that is what we could do is leave it for now and come back to that maybe at a separate time when it does come out, that'll be fun. What struck me, and for those listening, it takes almost entirely on a train, and as you already described it.
No, not entirely.
No, I said almost entirely.
It's not even almost entirely, but less than half, I'd say, the movie.
Is that true? Okay, so I'm just remembering badly, but because I remember they get off the train, and there is a, I thought that was kind of a last section, but I guess that's the second act in the play, right?
That's exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
I thought at first, I thought going into it, because I didn't read anything about it, but when you sent me the link, I just watched it, that, this is like going back now to, in a way, full circle to...
You watched the film.
Yeah, I know. And then
I'm happy to talk about it. I thought you hadn't seen it.
Oh, no. I saw it. You sent me the link. I watched it. Yeah.
Okay, so what was it you were saying?
Oh, I was just saying that I know this is a personal story, but also it comes full circle in the sense that one of your first films took place on a train. So it was. I thought that's a nice symmetry there, too.
My second film, Tracks.
Yeah.
Dennis Hopper, yes, that takes place on a... That is largely on a train.
There
is no relationship between those two films. I can't make any kind of connection on that at all.
I was just trying to kind of make a loose connection, that's all.
No, there's no connection except that the stories both take place on trains.
Well, that's a big one, and then you've directed them.
So did you enjoy seeing it? How did you like it?
Yeah, I did. I mean, first of all, Tana, again, I with each film, she just delivers a deeper performance. So I would say that this was a very demanding.
Astonishing.
Yeah, and this is probably the most demanding role for her, because it's the least obviously like or, familiar in terms of her experience. So, but I guess they call it acting for a reason,
Yep, sure can call it acting for a reason. And you should feel free to, call her and interview her for whatever.
Thank you.
You wish to. She'd be happy to talk about it.
As leading up to the to when that does get worked out in 2018 or whenever it is, I surely will. And she's really a sweetheart, so it would be a pleasure. It's nice to bring on people that, are just happy to do things like that. So I appreciate it. How was it from your standpoint? How did you shoot the film? Was it all on it was still on a set, I assume, right? The first act.
Yeah, it's it's very hard to explain. Okay. I'd rather not go into the whole detail of that now. But it was created much more in the editing room than anywhere else, and than any film that I've made, and that fascinated me.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a whole other story. And since
I understand,
since you said we'll talk about it subsequently, let's not talk about this.
That's
right
a good
now.
Idea. Yeah, that's fine. In fact, it makes sense to kind of wait till people can actually go see it after they hear us talk about it. Well, you know, you did send me a bunch of films that filled in some gaps for me. So, you know, it was just it was like an amazing experience to immerse myself in those films. And there's a few. First,
I don't know which ones you've seen.
I know. I'll tell you so you're not left at a disadvantage. Well, for one, you sent me Sitting Duck. I happen to have Tracks. And I have and a Safe Place, or I have a Safe Place because I have that BBS box, that Criterion,
right?
That I stole from Criterion at one point. And then I think Tracks, caught up with Tracks on my own. And then you sent me Sitting Ducks, which was just this amazing film. And you, I didn't even recognize you for your first appearance in that film. You were young, but also
young.
You were young.
Sitting Ducks would be 1979, I think, I shot it. So,
yeah.
What is that, 35 years ago? Yeah, I was young, that's for sure.
When did you meet Zach Norman? I know he was in Tracks, so with Dennis Hopper and...
He wasn't just in Tracks, he raised the money for Tracks.
Ah, okay.
What happened was I made a Safe Place, and after it came out, it was so attacked by the entire world that nobody would give me money to make another film. And I had this strange friend, Howard Zucker, who was acting under the name Zach Norman.
Yeah.
And he was in the business of raising money for films in Europe and distributing them. So I asked him to raise the money for my second film, since I couldn't get it from any conventional studio. There were only 7 studios then, and each one of them turned me down on Tracks. The only thing they wanted less than a movie about Vietnam was a movie with Dennis Hopper. That was after he made The Last Picture Show, and he was sort of anathema to them. And I was not much better, since The Safe Place had been a disaster commercially. So Zach went out and raised the money.
Oh.
$1 million to make that film. Then, at the same time, my company I was working with, BBS, Bert Schneider and BBS,
right,
had made a documentary about the Vietnam War.
Yes, I know.
Hearts and Minds.
Hearts and Minds are one of the great classics of all time.
And Columbia refused to release it because the government asked the head of Columbia not to. And Warner Brothers agreed, as long as they would be given, they could buy the film from Columbia for $1 million, but they didn't want to spend $1 million. Zach had raised $1 million for me to make Tracks, and I persuaded Zach, who was not at all political, but nonetheless was kind enough to go along with it, to use that $1 million to distribute Hearts and Minds.
Right.
So that's what we did with that, and I sent Zach back out then to try to raise money once again, and by this time Hearts and Minds had won the Academy Award, and we got a lot of attention, but for Tracks, we could only raise $500,000 at that point. So we made the film for $500,000, and that's why he's in the film, because he said he was guarding his money.
Well, he says, and I know this firsthand, that in addition to his relationship with you, that being partly responsible for Hearts and Minds is the most important thing he's ever done in his professional life. He's the most proud of it.
It's nice he feels that way, since he didn't want to do it, and he was completely non-political at the time.
Understood.
And he did it because he's got a very good heart, but he was not at all Bert Schneider, who produced it, and myself, who... We were very involved in the anti-war, Vietnam War movement. Zach was completely non-political. So for him to do it was doubly nice. He just did it out of really a kind heart, which is why I've used them in practically every movie ever since.
It's true. Was it just, are you just a super loyal guy? Are you just amazing? Are you just...
No, I think he's a great, funny character.
Yes.
A great eccentric character. And that comes in many films, that comes in very handy. I could always count on him.
Comic relief.
A certain kind of off the wall comic relief, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, he certainly...
And especially when I put him together with my brother, they're the two most eccentric people. You said you saw Sitting Ducks, right?
I saw Sitting Ducks, yeah. I agree. Their chemistry is remarkable.
Yep, and it was like that in life. And I had them both on the train with me when I was shooting Tracks. My brother was sort of the guy who was watching the money, and Zach was the guy who had raised the money. And they were kind of watching each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to see, and at one point I stuck them in front of the camera, and their chemistry was so good on film that I decided to make Sitting Ducks.
What is the experience for your brother, Michael Emil? What is the experience of making a movie? Because it's surprising, given how natural he is. He's so curious and so unique to watch. I mean...
He's definitely curious and unique to watch. He's very natural, but he's also he's very eccentric. So
yeah.
I just told him, we're going to put you in different situations. You're going to react the way you would react. And he said, okay. So that's what he did in the film. He never memorized a line of dialogue. And with Zach's help, I got this fantastic performance out of
it. You know, I don't mean to dwell on it too much, but I want people to make a point of seeing it, because there's one scene in particular where...
That's a perfect example of what I mean, because I did not tell my brother that I was going to send Zach in.
I didn't think you did.
I told my brother to get undressed, get in the bathtub, to do his exercises with that hand gripping thing,
right,
and that I was going to send in the young woman who he was interested in the movie, just to go on the edge of the tub and get into a conversation with him. That's what I told him to expect. Then I sent Zach in naked to get into the tub next to him. And my brother has certain, how should I put it? He has certain discomfort with a nude male too close to him. He'd never experienced that. And I had Zach watching him and saying how excited he was to be on the trip with him. And it got my brother crazy, and he kept trying to get him out of the tub. And it was all on the first take that I got the best part of that scene. So I used my brother for his own peculiar reactive qualities.
The limo is sitting there. Everything is set. We got everything done.
Do you think anybody may know about the garage where we're hidden
now?
Nobody
knows anything. Everything I've ever done my whole life works smooth. What's the matter with you? Just relax. This is a chance of a lifetime.
Simon and Sydney have a plan.
We have $724,360, not $750,000.
And what's the difference? When you're rich, you're rich.
Life has other ideas.
The plane's not coming till Monday morning.
You swore to me that it would be on Friday.
How did I get into this thing with a crazy guy like you?
That's a great car, you know?
You know how to drive?
Yeah.
You want to make some bread?
How much bread?
They're on the road.
Does anybody know where we're going? Does anybody know what road I should be taking?
In hot water.
What the hell are you doing getting into my bathtub?
You get a hooker for 50 bucks. Let's get a couple of broads up here.
You're behaving like a deviant.
I'm gonna do you like?
And getting in over their heads.
Do you ever consider the relationship between peculiar, offbeat actors? I can tell from watching your films that you cast from the gut. You're obviously very active in the casting. I don't know if you hire people to cast your films, but
No, I cast them all myself.
It's clear, yeah. So I would have been surprised to hear it otherwise. But there seems to be a dichotomy between your gut way of casting and the commercial imperative. It's like you're going for actors that you like to work with, that charm you on some level, at least artistically, if not personally. Karen Black, one of my favorite character actors, and she's just beautiful, and what a lovely actress she was. And was in a number of very commercial successes, don't get me wrong, but again, it shows like an eye for a particular type of performance Maybe you can talk about it a little. What attracts you to actors like Karen Black?
Well, I chose Karen because Karen Black had been my second girlfriend in life. The first one being an actress named Brenda Vaccaro. I don't know if you know who she is.
And, yes, of course I know Brenda Vaccaro. I've seen Midnight Cowboy.
Oh, well, good.
Wasn't she in that?
She's done your homework, so.
Was she in that? Wait a minute.
Yes, she was.
She was, right? Okay.
Yes.
No, I know Brenda Vaccaro. She was a very popular actress for many years.
Okay, yeah. Well, that was my first girlfriend.
Okay.
And Karen was my second. And at the point that I made the film you're talking about, Can She Bake a Cherry Pie?
Yeah.
I was at a very low point emotionally. My first wife had just left me. I was totally depressed. And I thought I needed somebody to sort of play me walking around New York, talking to themselves because their partner had just left them.
Yeah.
And I spoke to Karen, who was, as I said, a close friend, about that. And she said, let me play you. So I said, okay, and that's what we did.
Oh, I see. And now that you mention this and you talk to me about it, you explain it, I'm starting to see something maybe beginning to emerge, which is the female perspective.
For sure.
You know, I didn't see it before that.
Karen and I had very similar emotional kind of sensibilities, and I knew that she could play basically the me, the internal me, of being depressed at being left and then trying to find a happy ending, starting the movie with an unhappy beginning, which is her walking around Central Park talking to herself,
yeah,
like I had done when my wife left me, and see what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we made that film.
Coming over here?
Sure. What's your name?
Z.
Z? Is that a short name for something, or is that a full name?
I look real pitiful.
No, I'm just sympathetic.
I'm glad you sat here. Eli, I want a baby.
What?
I would like to have a baby. Not with you, but I really want one.
Emotionally, she's completely unpredictable.
That is the guy.
What guy?
That is the guy who was at the cafe!
I'm used to being very sure that a woman likes me and me making a choice. In her case, I'm really quite unsure.
I think you're very nice. Kind of funny, but very nice.
And the more I get to like her, the more uneasy I get about this sort of thing.
Point is that you're a little nuts.
I want you to understand that there's a direct relationship between hanging upside down like this and my ability in sex.
You look around and you say, where am I? What happened? Where am I? My God, who are you? Eli, who are you? Where'd they go? What happened there? I thought, do you know what I mean?
She had a remarkable career. She seemed like she just worked with all the great filmmakers of her day.
That film, I also found Frances Fisher and gave her her first acting part in the movie.
Who?
Frances Fisher.
Oh, Frances Fisher, of course. Right, who would later marry Clint Eastwood, is that right? Or they were an item anyway,
yes,
right?
Yeah. No, they were married and they have a daughter, who's an up-and-coming actress, yeah.
Yeah, it was just...
That's another film. That's a film, you know, called what is that film called?
Which one? Of yours?
Yes. What film is Frances Fisher in? I'm trying to tell you whether you actually do know the film.
Oh, well, I think she might have been in Shopping or one of the I don't know how you describe that grouping of films, but where Female Obsessions...
Yeah, well, she was in one of the Female Obsessions, but it wasn't Shopping. It was about wanting baby fever.
Yes, of course. I did see, honestly, I saw it, but it's already been a month, and I did. You know, part of the thing, Henry, is when you binge watch anything, and I watched at least half dozen.
You don't know which one is which. Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah, I mean, well, but your films are.
You just need to let me know as we speak about it which films you have seen. So we won't be speaking about a film you haven't seen.
Oh yeah, that's a good way to go. Well, it's, you know, you talk about your heartbreak, and then the next couple of films actually deal more with that. Always and
yeah, always was the deepest examination of that, because
right.
I could not quite deal with it, frankly, completely in Can't You Bake a Cherry Pie, so I needed Karen Still to play me. And then after making that, I realized, well, it didn't solve the problem. I think the only way to solve the problem is to make a film with my ex-wife in which we actually are playing ourselves and go through what we went through during the process in which she, at which time she left me, and that I didn't want her to leave. And so that's when I sort of invented that film. Always but not forever, as we call it.
Right, Always but not forever. It's a beautiful film, actually. It's really touching.
Thank you. Yeah, it's quite an honest film, actually, and that's part of that sort of sequence of films, which is followed by New Year's Day, which looked at trying to start over after the end of relationships. I finally worked out some of my problems.
Problems. Yeah. Well, I don't know if you skipped Someone to Love, but it's in that same time frame, even though you're kind of working it out. It's very meta. It's your most meta film in the sense that you're working out things through a series of auditions and in a theater that's about to be shut down. I'm trying to remember.
That's Someone to Love.
Yeah. Right. Now, when did you meet Orson Welles?
I met him for my first film, A Safe Place.
Okay. And then did you just automatically connect with him? I mean, what can you describe that relationship? Because it's obviously one of the most special relationships and important relationships in your life.
Did you read the book, My Lunches with Orson?
I sure did. My sense was that was later on, though, those lunches.
Oh, yeah. Of course, that was later on when we were very, very close.
In
the last few years of his life.
Right.
No, I went to New York to persuade him to be in my first movie. Peter Bogdanovich was a mutual friend of ours, and he arranged the meeting. And when I got to New York, Orson was not hospitable at all. And this gigantic man in these huge purple silk pajamas greeted me at the door with a very gruff, "What do you want?" And I said, "I'm trying to persuade you to be in my first film." And he said, "Where's the script?" And I said, "Well, there isn't going to be a script if you're not in it, so I didn't write the script, but I can tell you what I want you for." He said, "If there's no script, I'm not interested." And he tried to shove me out the door as politely as he could. And I said, "Look, I just flew here from Los Angeles. This was the Plaza in New York." And I said, "You're going to give me an hour of your time." And he said, "Well, I'll sit here, but I won't listen." And I think it's funny to remember him sitting there crossing his arms, this gigantic creature in purple silk pajamas. And I started trying to sell him on doing this part of the magician.
Right.
Because I knew he was in life a magician. Who was going to try to make something disappear. And I finally got him. I knew I got him when he looked out of the corner of his eyes and he said, "Make what disappear?" And I said, "I'm not going to tell you that unless you do the movie."
So he said,
"Well, can I wear a cape?" And I knew I had him.
Yes, you did. But you were smart. You had a sense of how to get through, like that the magician overacting was the way in, right? Because he had a child,
that's
almost
exactly
like a child,
right.
An almost childlike love for magic. It's
magic, everything to do with magic, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, that's how I knew how to land him. And then we did become very close friends.
Well, how did that develop?
Because he... Huh?
I'm just curious how that developed. Obviously, the dynamic has to change because on some level you need to no longer be mentor and mentoree or whatever that, earlier...
Well, we were never like that.
Okay.
Were always quite
equal.
The big moment came in I think it was about my third or fourth day of filming A Safe Place, and Orson had arrived, and I didn't know him very well. As I said, I'd only met him that one time and hired him, and he had arrived days before he was going to do his week's work on the film, and he asked me how it was going, and I told him, I don't know if you know this story, I told him that the crew was giving me a very hard time, that you heard this particular story?
No, I don't think so.
So I said the crew was giving me a very hard time every time I want to shoot something creatively in an interesting and unusual way. They kept saying to me, and the cinematographer who had just come from Love Story, Dick Cortina, said to me, it won't cut. And I said, well, I just want to try this. He said, but it won't cut. And they were tremendously resistant to me. First of all, it was the Vietnam War was going on. I was this hippie kind of with a long ponytail and white Capizio dance shoes, and I looked very weird to them, and I was directing my first movie. And I was unconventional and wanted to do certain things in a very unusual way. And everything I tried to get them to do, they resisted. Every single thing. The cameraman said it won't cut. The script supervisor said it won't cut. So when Orson asked me, how's it going? I said, it's very frustrating because they're resisting me on every level. They're saying things won't cut. And he said, listen, next time they tell you that, just tell them it's a dream sequence. And I said, a dream sequence? Why is it? Never mind, why just do that? Then the next morning, sure enough, on the first setup, I asked them to do this kind of unusual shot, and they said it won't cut. It's not in the script. And I said, it's a dream sequence. And they said, what? Oh, well, then why don't I get on my back? The cinematographer said I could do a beautiful psychedelic. They used the word psychedelic, you know. And suddenly they were friendly and easygoing, and for the rest of the shoot, they were dolls. And I said, went to Orson, and I said, I can't believe this. Why is this working? Why does that, what does that mean? And he said, you know, these people are very hardworking people. They have rules in their life. They get up at a certain time early in the morning. They get to a set. There's a lot of rules to filmmaking. There's rules to their life. The only place they know that are free of rules is in their dreams. So if you tell them it's a dream sequence, they are freed from their conventional concepts of what can be and cannot be done, and what is correct and not correct, and then they can be free to be creative. And in fact, they came up with some of the most interesting ideas for me once they were freed of that sort of convention that something that is real that has to be literal in a certain kind of visual way. And there's not been a single movie since then that I haven't used that at one time or another with an actor or with a crew member to try to get them free from a certain inhibition. Telling them it's a dream sequence. Orson's words have come in handy at every single one of my 20 films, 21 films.
That's a great story. Shocking that you still use it, because I was going to say, maybe in 1970, when you were I assume you were shooting A Safe Place around 1970, that there were still enough people that come from an older mentality in terms of the filmmaking style. And even though
that's what I just said.
Well, I understand, but
the cinematographer had come from doing Love Story.
Yeah, I understand. I'm just saying though that things by the late 60s, early 70s were shifting in terms of a lot very quickly. So
by 1970 nothing had shifted yet.
Really? Okay.
No.
Yeah.
You mean because of Easy Rider? I don't know what you mean.
Yeah, a few films.
Studio films were still studio films. This was a Columbia picture. It starred Jack Nicholson and Tuesday Weld and Orson. They expected a normal kind of director, and they got this kid with a ponytail.
A hippie.
Who had some weird ideas about what to try to do.
Yeah.
To them, a hippie. So Orson gave me the magic word.
Got it.
That really enabled me to break through that kind of resistance. And it was a great contribution. And as I said, there's not a single movie, and it doesn't matter what decade it is or what you think might be popular in films, there's still a lot of resistance from traditional crew members to, non-traditional filmmaking.
So is it your
they
sense?
Get taught things and they...
Do you think that there was a period in the early 70s where there were enough young directors like yourself, though, that were experimenting, where things started, where the crew started to become more, at least, familiar?
No, they got crews. They got different crews. They got European cinematographers who had been to a different Nouvelle Vague. It was completely, in America, the studio system had just barely registered with a blip, and then they got very much back to their conventional.
That's a good point. That's a good point. All the Czech cinematographers were shooting for the American filmmakers, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
yeah. But I had gotten Dick Cretina from Love Story.
Love Story.
Get one of the Czech photographers. My point was that Orson figured out how to bypass the conventions of the time, and was enormously. I mean, it was a huge help to me because I was really at a loss at that point.
And then you realize, well, maybe I can start to do the same thing, and with other challenges that come up, find those bypasses. That's a way to go. Just try to find the bypass that'll work for whatever challenge you're dealing with.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I guess that's what directing is kind of all about. You know, is the solutions, right? It's a series of solutions, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Then starts the series of these films that, you know, I mean, with some exceptions like Deja Vu and a few others, but that which. Another one I really loved, but that were dealing with women's, issues. Yeah, I guess it is issues. I'm trying to find the exact right word, but issues covers it just fine. Did you get a lot of, did the women coming in and that you cast and did people understand what you were doing? Did you understand what you were doing when you started making these films? And like nobody else was doing that.
Did I understand what I was doing?
Yeah, well, I mean,
of course, what I was doing.
You know what I'm saying? I mean,
let me answer you.
Yes, please.
I felt very aware that women were barely addressed in films at that time. That films were being made by men for men. Actually, by men with a very boy-baby kind of mentality, for some 16-year-old boy in the Midwest who would go and see it over and over again. And it seemed to me that women were being completely ignored by American filmmaking. So what I had wanted to do from the very beginning was try to use film as a way to help people feel less alone in life, since I'd gone through my own stuff and felt that women were barely recognized as what they were going through in terms of the filmmaking of the period. And so that was the reason that I actually started. I first wrote for A Safe Place and then made the movie A Safe Place and made the subsequent films to try to make women, you know, help women feel less alone when they're sitting in the movie theater, to let them know that it's going to be okay, kind of, to let them know. There was a wonderful record by the Firestein Theater, I don't know if you know who they are, called "We're All Bozos on This Bus." And just let them know that we're all going through this kind of same trip, and to make them feel less alone. It's like they're the only ones going through it. That was sort of the goal of A Safe Place and many of the female-centered films that I did.
Did you find that men were relating to the films as well? I mean, did you find that...
No, not at all. No, men were walking out. We got complaints from all... When the most successful of those films, which arguably was Eating, all over the country, we got complaints from movie theater managers that men were like walking out of the movies and that the women were getting into arguments, and women started going with their friends or with their mothers, or the whole second wave of filmmaking was fascinating because there were practically no men in the audience. Men reacted so badly to the film and women so well, and it was a fascinating thing to discover.
What about in Europe? Were these distributed in Europe?
Yes. A Safe Place was very successful. It's the only one of my films that was a huge success in France, and quite successful in England. Because they had a separate culture in terms of film as an art form. I don't think that had anything to do with male and female. That had more to do with the idea of film as entertainment or art. And they were willing to look at film as poetry, for instance, which is what the French critics all called it, rather than as a linear and conventionally unfolding narrative, which is what American filmmaking was about, still is largely about.
I guess when you showed films like Eating and Baby Fever in Europe, I'm just wondering what the reception was to those films.
It's been very very good, very positive. Strange places where you don't expect that. Why my films should be very popular in Poland, for instance, I have no idea.
You never figured that out.
But they are.
Mm-hmm.
No, I can't figure that out. Or Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic as it now is. It's just fascinating. No, it's just very interesting. I can't quite make any, you know, consequential discoveries as a result of it. Just that they're, I think the biggest thing is that Europeans have been from the beginning willing to understand film as art,
yeah,
film as something other than just storytelling and in the conventional sense. And American audiences never really have, though there was a brief period there in the early 70s where it looked like things were going to change.
It did. It did
you
seem
think
like,
it did?
Yeah. I mean, it did seem like that. And it's amazing how,
How old are you?
I'm 53. Uh-huh. So I mean,
in 70 you weren't born. Were you born?
Yeah, yeah. So I would have been a teenager in the 70s.
What year were you born?
63. Yeah. Two months before. 63. 2 months before, you know, Kennedy was assassinated.
I see.
So I was alive. Yeah, that was my president. My parents, Henry, my parents were very, very into films, you know, so I grew up and they were playing films by Henry Jaglom. And I have to say that, I mean, you know, it's though, but they also Antonioni and you know, Fellini, and they loved Bergman.
Well, you're lucky you had, that's good that you had that background. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, when
then you understand how completely different films were there than they were here, and what the expectancies of audiences were.
Yeah, yeah. And I grew up with, you know, this has had a big impact on the kind of films that I was comfortable with and that I would be attracted to. So, you know, I remember my older cousins and, you know, parents were in, you know, when like a movie like, you know, again, Midnight Cowboy or Taxi Driver, any of those types of films were coming out, like they were on everybody's radar. You know, I knew about it. Uh-huh. I was living in New York, so it was like playing all over the place. It wasn't only because my parents were, you know, interested in that, as they were artists themselves. So that, you know, just I was very lucky in that way. So I've always been interested in the character-driven film myself. It's, you know, probably,
which is why you're now writing about film or doing programs about film.
Yeah, the above, exactly. Right, sure. And always grateful when I come across a film that you know still manages to pull it off. I remember also you recently sent me links to some letters that you that blew my mind. Your correspondences with Elia Kazan.
Letters. Oh, my exchange with Kazan. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about it?
Read these correspondences, and I'm wondering, I want you to talk a little bit about it, because it's so incredible.
About Kazan?
Yeah, and just about how this started, and you say in your letters early on, I hate you and I love you, and it's you know, and he was just very open
no,
to
it. No, I didn't say that. I didn't say I love you. I said I hate you, and I love your films, and I loved your book that I just read. It's the best book I've ever read about theater and film, and I don't understand the contradiction between the disgusting human being that you are and this brilliant book that you've written, which is the best book about film and theater, which is his autobiography.
A Life.
Have you read it?
Yeah. Elia Kazan, A Life.
Yeah.
How do you... Did you just assume that when you say something like, and by the way, I'm in agreement with you because he named names, I totally get it. Did you expect him to write back and be so open-minded about, you know, an understanding about this dichotomy and your take on him?
I had no idea, but we both came from the Actors Studio, so I knew we had that in common. And his book was so brilliant that I just thought I would be honest with him and say, you know, you're a shit. And to people like myself, you're the epitome of the worst things that people have done in Hollywood history. And on the other hand, you make the best films of anybody of that. As I was growing up, there was nobody else like Kazan at all. And that was before Kubrick and before, you know, the Europeans, before Fellini and...
Mm-hmm.
and Antonioni and all of that. Kazan was making brilliant films, and yet he was this disgusting human being. So I said to him, you are a shit. It's an article of faith in my life that you're a shit, and yet you've written this best book, and I don't know how to reconcile that. And he wrote back, he was interested in my letter, and he ended up wanting to meet me. So I ended up meeting him, and that's what those letters are a document about.
What was it like to finally to indeed meet him?
It was confusing because I liked him very, very much. And that was disturbing. It was I lost a couple of friends because of that.
Did you?
Yeah, because I had when my wife had our first daughter, who was pregnant with our first child, I gave a party for her at Vivica Linford's house. You know who Vivica Linford is? Did you see Last Summer in the Hamptons?
Yes, I know who she is. She's a great character actress.
Did you see Last Summer in the Hamptons?
That one I did not see, but that's probably the only one. Oh. But I know I've seen a number of clips. I know the actress. I will watch it. I could have said I did see it, but I'm not going to lie to you. Go ahead. It definitely. Go ahead. I apologize.
Talk?
Yep. No. Go ahead. Please finish the story.
So I gave a party for some of my New York friends to meet my comparatively new wife, who was then pregnant with our first child. And Vivica Linford, who I'd become friendly with in East Hampton and had not yet made the movie with, said, use my townhouse for the party. I said, great. So I invited her to that. In the meantime, I had the encounter with Kazan and liked him. So I invited him, since he was on the same street as Vivica, in a little house nearby. I had not known that they had been walking their dogs for 30 years and not talking to each other.
Oh.
Because of what he had done. And he came to the party, and half the people there got furious at me for inviting him, including Jules Pfeiffer, who I'd been very friendly with, who wouldn't talk to me after that, because I'd invited Kazan. These people, mostly the older ones who had suffered more directly from Kazan's disgusting behavior, could not forgive him, of course. And I had been naive enough to think, you know, time had gone by, it was all right to invite him to this party to meet my new wife, my new pregnant wife. So that was quite an important thing for me to realize that this wasn't just a past situation, but in many people's lives, this was a very big and real, you know, very real, continuous. You really should see Last Summer in the Hamptons before we talk about this.
I'm going to watch it. I'll watch it tonight. It tonight because it deals with that during the film itself.
You'll see why.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know what else to tell you about Kazan except that it was interesting and complicated.
Well, did
Orson was furious at me when he learned later that I had done that too. And he said that one thing he could never forgive was Kazan. I just could never look at him again. And I certainly understood that.
Yet some people can some people can draw the distinction, I guess, because, you know.
No, but for me it was not real because he was a villain of my childhood and not my contemporary life. So I didn't have the same response, you know. I knew intellectually that he was a horrible human being who had done horrible things, but I had not quite, once I got to know him and like him, I'd forgotten.
Yeah.
Who he really was and what it would mean to these other people to invite him to this party, and it ruptured several of my closest friendships with older people.
Did you were you able to go back and patch up any of those relationships? Because
some of them, of course, I was, but
yeah.
Vivica Linford, I certainly was. I had not yet made the movie with her.
Right. Which I'll watch.
What?
Yeah, I said which I will absolutely watch. It has to, of course, it will be the one we dwelled on, the one that, you know, that one that I didn't get to. Thanks very much. It's the one that kicks me in the ass.
That's that's the way life is.
But it's curious because on a different scale, Henry, I have a niece who voted for Trump, and I don't, you know, my sister, it's come up in the family.
You voted for Trump?
No. I have a niece.
What did you just say?
My niece. My niece.
My niece.
My sister's daughter. Yeah. My sister's daughter.
Okay.
And who's a grown woman.
I voted for Trump.
Yeah. So yeah, there's so many levels to it that, so there's been, I'm going to be real brief about it because it's not about my family, but that it's caused a number, it comes up, you know, people feel very, very impassioned about it. So it's come up and it's caused rifts and it's causing complications, you know.
Yeah,
and my sister is at a loss. She's caught in between a rock and a hard place. But I guess what I'm doing on a smaller scale is she didn't name names. She's not villain, but, you know, she's young. And, you know, but it's interesting. You have feelings for somebody, love in my case, and yet they're, you know, they've aligned themselves with somebody very despicable. So it's a really complicated issue. And, you know, I don't know if right or wrong is even the way to describe it. But I could see that you put yourself becoming entangled and friends with him. Yeah, it puts you in quite a very difficult place. I really appreciate, okay, you know, you're taking the time.
Not at all.
You know, I mean, for me,
my
it's
pleasure.
Me too. I mean, I just, somebody who's created so many just remarkable films and devoted their life to making art like you, it's a...
Thank you, yeah.
Really, you know.
But do see Last Summer in the Hamptons, okay?
I have a copy on me, as you well know. After we say goodbye, I'm going to put it on tonight, waiting for Rachel Maddow.
It's about exactly that, about making art.
Right.
Exactly about that.
Yeah.
More than any of the other films, I would say it's about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay. It's very good speaking with you. If you need anything or want anything else, give me a call.
I will. Thank you very much. And we'll talk again, you know, around Zakopane. And
whenever you want, just get back in touch with me, okay?
All right. Thank you very much, Henry.
Okay. It's a pleasure.
All right. Have a good night. Bye-bye now.
Gonna take a sentimental journey, gonna set my heart at ease, gonna make a sentimental journey to renew old memories. We'll meet again, don't know where. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day.